Good morning. It's 9:30 on a Sunday morning, and it's time for the International Connection once again. And we are in the middle of an extended radio series on mind control. And today we are concluding a lecture by John Rappaport entitled The CIA Mind Control in Children. John Rappaport is an investigative journalist and author of U.S. Government Mind Control Experiments on Children and AIDS, Inc., and was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize by LA Weekly for his coverage of the military takeover at the University of Salvador in 1982. We'll also be, the conclusion of this lecture is only about 15 minutes, and we'll be beginning an interview with Valerie Wolf following this in this show. You're listening to CKLN 88.1.
They could be thinking that what they want to do is program these kids who would later supposedly emerge in prominent positions in society, so that then they would have long-term control of the society by controlling people in power positions. And she said, well, she didn't say yes, but she said, you know, she said, yeah, I mean, that makes sense. Right? So she said, you know, the Nazis got a hold of the intelligentsia. They turned the intelligentsia. That was one of their first victories. They were able to either silence or bring the intelligentsia into their fold. So it was a major project. And she said to me, you know, they brought a lot of doctors over here after the war, and not just the rocket scientists, you know, they brought a lot of doctors over here. And all throughout this testimony, you will read sprinkled here, doctors with German accent. Was it Green? Was it a Greenberg, a German Jew, but he didn't look like a Jew? He had blonde hair and da-da-da and whatever, you know, that kind of stuff. So I would say this is a Nazi project, but a lot of the Nazis are American-born. I want to continue, get to the end, we'll do questions later. But it shouldn't be excused or explained away on that basis. Because, as we know, if we look at Nazi psychiatry, for example, they learned a lot from the Americans, especially about eugenics. So this is not something you just say, well, the Nazis took over. No, this is homegrown stuff. This is Americana at its worst, at its lowest form. This is also what I would say, you could say this is the sub-sub-basement that you walk into when you are a materialist, when that is your philosophy. And I don't mean that you just simply are a materialist in the sense that you want money, possessions. I mean philosophically. The materialist position is that we are meat and tissue and cells and electrical impulses, and that's it. And when that system collapses, we're gone, never to return. And my own feeling is that when you espouse and embrace that philosophy, the ultimate sub-basement that you end up in is that sub-basement. That's where you end up. Finally, that's where it all comes out. And I must say, even though I admire many of the researchers on psychedelics and feel that they are basically liberating types of people, I think some of them make a mistake when they start talking about, well, it's all chemicals anyway. What difference does it make? You know, we're only dealing with chemical reactions anyway, so what's this nonsense about consciousness separate from chemicals? And they're using that, of course, to say, which is understandable, why is the government trying to outlaw the use of psychedelics if, in fact, all consciousness is chemical anyway? They're just being selective in their choices of chemical. You know, they're saying alcohol, yes, and LSD, no. But I think that these people have a little bit to think about in this one area. I'm not trying to put them down at all. In fact, I admire them. But I think when they start talking about, well, consciousness is just chemicals anyway, no, I'm afraid I'd have to disagree with that. I think that it's a lot more than chemicals. You can certainly make people do very bizarre things with chemicals, and you can make them suffer a great deal because we are in these bodies here. But it's a lot more than that. So that's where I think you wind up. you wind up with this crazy idea about programming people. That's where I think you end up with this stuff. Now, on the plus side, if we know this, if we understand what's happening here, and therapists can be brought into this whole dialogue, then we are talking about bridging something that's very unmiddle class into the middle class and into people who normally don't consider these kinds of things, because we're talking therapists here. Private practice therapists who are sitting there, and patients come into their office and say, I was part of CIA mind control. Now, I'm not saying that the middle class is, you know, this fabulous entity that we have to somehow court, but I am saying that this is an issue which can get some people involved that normally do not get involved, and if they are so willing, they can create some havoc with the government. And that's my next point here. One of the reasons that I am going into this and getting involved in it is because I want people to begin to see the government for what it actually is. And I think that this is a way of doing that. Unequivocally coming to it. People who say, the government, yes. And if we just get the more right people in, and a little more funding, more research, and more funding for research, and more this, you know, more that, everything's going to work out, and we get the nice guys, and elect Bill and don't elect George, and elect Jim and don't elect Phil, and, you know. And it's all this kind of whipsawing stuff that I see every time an election comes around, you know. Oh, we got to vote for Bill because if we don't, we'll get George and this and that, and, you know, and more money for research, and if they'd only, you know, da ba da bop da bop da bop, you know. And it's like a vice that people are in. And everybody knows it. So, I have a statement here from Colin Ross, a very interesting man. Never heard of him before. He's a psychiatrist in Richardson, Texas. He's been researching the CIA for 20 years. Every time a MKUltra type researcher dies, he sends away Freedom of Information Act requests because he figures, well, the guy's dead. They'll be more likely to release the documents now. And he just... he's very cute with us. He accumulates little this, little of that. MKUltra had about 139 to 150 sub-projects. Nobody knows what they all were, or even if that's the total. That's the basic mind control project of the CIA after the Second World War. And he has files on as many of these as he can possibly get. Okay. I have in my possession about 80 of the 149 sub-project files which I obtained through Freedom of Information Act, filing requests with the CIA on each deceased investigator of interest. I like that. So he says, neurosurgeons at Tulane, Yale, and Harvard did extensive research on brain electrode implants with intelligence funding and combined brain implants with large numbers of drugs, including hallucinogens. So while they're telling Tim Leary and Richard Alpert to get out of Harvard because a few people are taking acid and enjoying it, there's other people there who are inserting electrodes in people's brains and then giving them acid. MKUltra alone included four sub-projects on children. One was conducted at the International Children's Summer Camp in Maine by an unwitting investigator. The MKUltra subproject file in my possession for this project states that the CIA's interest in this research was in establishing contact with foreign nationals of potential future operational use by the CIA. The children who served as subjects in the project were as young as 11 years old. Multiple personality patients in treatment throughout the United States and Canada are describing involvement in mind control research that is much more sophisticated than MKUltra. Deliberate sexual abuse of children to make them more dissociative. And then he ends up simply by saying, I would be pleased to testify at length at any hearings on CIA and military mind control. Colin Ross, MD, psychiatrist, Richardson, Texas. Here's a statement from a therapist submitted anonymously. This is a therapist anonymously says, one client told me that they were made to believe they had been abducted by UFOs, so that if memories were retrieved, they would be discredited by the community. I found that kind of interesting. And other people mention satanic costumes, putting on satanic costumes CIA people did while they were doing, you know, their crazy stuff here. Here's John Boyd, PhD, clinical psychologist, practiced psychotherapy for 25 years, Ohio State University of Virginia. I've treated three patients whose memories of childhood abuse include the detailed recall of sophisticated mind control technology being inflicted upon them by, quote, experts in collusion with the patient's mentally disturbed parents. The independent reports of these individuals contain similar information of an esoteric and intricate nature concerning mind control technology, which, in my opinion, could be gained only through personal experience. The press says nothing. The press says zero about this. Here's a woman operating under the pseudonym, I believe, of Chandra Walker Michaels. I learned how to handle weapons, particularly how an ice pick left a neat hole, a hole that allowed so little blood to escape that the victim could remain in public view for hours before they would be discovered not to be napping. I was taken on planes to Germany and Egypt to assist Joe with arson, to Israel along with messages, to Mexico for terrorist activities. I remember a small laboratory in a partially exposed basement of a large building I visited many times, starting at age 4, south of Washington, D.C. At the age of 14, I was drugged and woke up on a stretcher. I heard men outside my door discussing how they had gotten me past the guards at Langley that night. At the age of 15, Joe introduced me to an elderly man he referred to as the Senator. At the Mayflower Hotel in Washington, D.C., the portly gentleman was brought to a room adjoining ours. Our closest space was filled with photographic equipment viewing the senator's scene. I refused to participate. I was severely punished. Now, just a word about the media, and then we'll take a break. One of the best payoffs of being a reporter for 15 years is that I've come to see this machine called the media and how it operates in a way that I never thought was possible, because I've talked to a lot of reporters, and they become the eyes and the mouth and the ears for everybody else. And since I'm now researching the Oklahoma City bombing, and I've done a lot of research on AIDS, and now this and other topics, there's a pattern that always seems to emerge. And the pattern is that there is a cover story that emerges very quickly after something either is revealed or it happens. Very quickly, a cover story comes to the fore. And then anything that does not fit the cover story is discarded. In the case of Oklahoma City, it happens to be, you know, basically that McVeigh is a redneck, McVeigh and a few of his friends are rednecks. The rednecks are connected to other rednecks that belong to militias, and the militias blew up the building, and that's it. We don't want to know anything else. They're all kind of crazy and stupid, and that's the end of the story. They rented a Ryder truck, knowing it could be traced. They bought 5,000 pounds of ammonium nitrate, knowing it could be traced, you know. Hey, business is suddenly picking up. Did you see this guy who came in and bought 5,000 pounds of ammonium nitrate? Wow. I thought business was kind of slow, and then all of a sudden, this guy, they came in like, you know, 15 or 20 cars, and they loaded it up and back to the station wagon, and they kept coming back for more, and they took it away, you know. I guess April is a really good planting month, you know. Like, they're really, you know, they got a lot of crops in mind here, you know. And that's the cover, right? And people are, you know, they were that stupid, and that's all we have to know about it. And McVeigh, 3 hours after the explosion, happens to be driving in a car without a license. And a cop stops him, and he says, I have to cite you for driving without a license. You'll have to appear. And McVeigh says, no problem. And then the officer looks at him, he says, she's writing out the citation. Right, he's going to give it to him and let him drive away. No problem. Driving without a license, you know. So what? No, you just appear, and then he looks, and he keeps looking, he keeps writing, he says, sir, do you have something under your windbreaker there? And McVeigh says, I have a weapon under my windbreaker. Pulls down a zipper, opens up the windbreaker. There is a 9mm Glock, a 5-inch knife hanging off of his belt. He's just killed, you know, 100 people, whatever. He's on a lonely road someplace with a 9mm. Cop stops him. He's going to let him go. He says he has a weapon. The cop then puts a service revolver to his head, disarms him, takes him to jail, puts him on ice for a few days until the feds say, you know, I mean, they work fast, these guys. 3 days, they know who did it. They know what happened. They come to the jail where he is, and they take him, right? By the way, I was told that initial reports placed McVeigh at Tinker Air Force Base in Oklahoma. One of the people who anonymously testifies in here and has been mentioned by other people says some of the mind control work was done on them at Tinker Air Force Base, right? Tinkerbell, right? So, you know, this is the scenario that's painted by the press, see? Now, the amazing, we talk about mind control here. Right? Now, the reporters that I talk to, this is the part that I'm talking about the media, because the rest of this we know about, but the reporters, how they slip and slide with this once the cover story is established, how they manage to keep from discovering anything or thinking about anything or just considering the insanity of the cover story itself is really something to behold. And I've been talking to a bunch of reporters down in Oklahoma City now, and you know, I just listen and we talk and it's all very chatty and everything. And like, for example, one guy who is a, this guy's on the Daily Oklahoman, which is the only paper in Oklahoma City, by the way. There's only one. So, and all he can talk about is the federal boys. The federal boys combing through the wreckage of the building. The federal boys. The federal boys were there, and they did this, and they told me, and the federal boys said this. And it's kind of like, you know, when a sports writer covers the Yankees, right? The slugger told me this, and, you know, he told me that he throws a curveball, man. He holds it this way, see? And this is how he does it. It's fantastic, you know. I went out with, had a beer with Mickey, you know? That kind of stuff. The federal boys told me that they couldn't find any other kind of bomb in the building at all. You know? And like, that's it. What else is there to know? You know, the federal boys, day after day, were going through the wreckage, and they told him that they couldn't find anything. And he, you know, and this guy would have talked for 3 hours about this if I let him. And that's how he keeps himself from figuring out what's going on. And each reporter has his own little scene. Right? And in the case of this one here, of course, now, Valerie Wolfen and one of her patients, you know, they say, look, we're not so sure we want to really get this exposed all the way out, because we know that the False Memory Syndrome Foundation right now has a stranglehold on the press. That's the cover story, see? And nobody cares that the board is composed of these guys with CIA, you know, mind control connections. That's the cover story that's laid down, and so everything else is irrelevant. So that's what we have to bust, is that cover story, with enough people coming forward saying it's not true.
I'm on the line with Valerie Wolfe, a social worker and therapist in the New Orleans area, And Valerie treats survivors of severe trauma and mind control. She also gave testimony at the Presidential Advisory Committee on Human Radiation Experiments in 1995. Welcome to the show, Valerie.
Oh, thank you.
I'd like to start off by asking you, what is your background and how did you become involved in treating survivors of mind control?
Well, I'm a clinical social worker, and I started working with survivors of trauma and sex abuse in about 1973 when I was a student at Syracuse University, and basically specialized in it. Gradually became a specialty. I worked at Family Service of Greater New Orleans and became the contract manager for all our child abuse contracts in 1984, and basically helped set up a whole sex abuse treatment program, got funding from the state. And then when I left there in 1990, I worked for a for-profit hospital and set up an inpatient program and picked up more clients. And then in June of 92, I was at the Eastern Regional Conference in Alexandria, Virginia, where the information on the mind control was released. And basically, I didn't go to the talk, but a colleague of mine did. And she had referred a client to me. And when she heard this talk, she immediately found me and said, I think this mutual client that we both knew is a victim of this mind control they're talking about. So when I came back to New Orleans, and basically I had a couple of clients where they had really worked hard in therapy, had been doing a lot, but all they could do was maintain, and even then they were in and out of the hospital. It's like they became flooded with thoughts of wanting to hurt themselves or wanting to kill themselves and had to be hospitalized in spite of everything. And I had two clients that started going downhill, and so I decided to follow what I had learned at the conference because I got the tapes, and lo and behold, both clients ended up being victims of mind control, and then it just kind of went from there.
So was that the first time you were introduced to this information about mind control experimentation, this presentation? This was the presentation by Corey Hammond?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had no idea.
Right.
Prior to that.
What did you suspect was going on in your clients before finding this out?
I really just felt like I was pretty unsophisticated. I mean, I was sophisticated for the time in terms of what I was doing, but looking back now, 5 years later, I was really pretty unsophisticated. And basically, I just thought we hadn't done enough work, you know, that... I just kept coming up with different things to try. But if you have someone who's a mind control survivor and you try to use traditional methods, I don't care how good you are or what you do, if you don't have access to the information, you can only go so far.
And how did you specifically verify that your clients were victims of mind control after you were exposed to this information?
Well, basically what I did is I followed what Corey Hammond, what was said in the tape, in terms of asking for the core and asking about the alphabet programs. It turns out that is absolutely, it was the best information at the time, but it's not the place to start. My clients have since taught me that there's a better way to start it, and it's easier, but both clients were just totally flooded when I started that way, you know, and inquiring about the alphabet programs. And in fact, one client, we got into it, and she did electric shock memories, and I didn't know what that was. I hadn't seen that before. Plus, I'd never been a therapist that did a lot of memories. I was with her for 24 hours because I was afraid to leave her, but I didn't get the sense she needed to be hospitalized. She just needed to finish it, and she finally did. And then the other client opened it up, got to that part of her system, talked, and then I happened to work late that night, and I work late one night, and I was in my office doing paperwork, and she showed up at my door and said, okay, you opened it up, and unless you do something by midnight, I have to die. I was like, oh, my God, what is it that we've opened up here? And you know, we ended up being able to contain it. And now when I started, I do a very, very differently. We don't get that kind of thing, you know. We start with containing it rather than right into the, because that's the end of it, mm-hmm. the alphabet, for all the programs and alphabet stuff. If it's there, is all the end of it.
Right, and by going into that at the beginning, you're saying that triggers a lot of memories.
What it did is, yes, triggered a lot of memories, and they just flooded mm-hmm. With all kinds of memories and the intensity and it was really hard because it took a couple of months for me to kind of wake up, because I felt responsible because they were saying, well, you opened this up, so you have to help with this. And then after about 3 months, when I was thoroughly exhausted, and basically I just said, wait a minute, I'm not responsible for this, you guys are. And that's when I began to, you know, kind of get a grip and set some limits, because the normal limits of normal therapy apply. And that first 3 months was difficult because I didn't know what applied and what didn't. I mean, it was almost like all the rules changed. So I just kind of put the rules back in place, mm-hmm. you know, in terms of limiting phone calls. I didn't have to work on weekends. I didn't have to work late nights. That they had survived all this time, and they were going to survive. I mean, the drive to survive is extremely strong in some of these clients. Mm-hmm. So I had to understand that.
And for other therapists that are possibly dealing with survivors of mind control, how is the knowledge of what the experimentation was, how does that explicitly help in therapy?
Well, what really helps is these clients can't tell you stuff directly. They really talk in metaphors. Also, the way that memories come back, I really use the Basque model, and which is first is behaviors that are as a result of things that happened in the past. Our memory, feelings, affect or feelings. People will have feelings that make absolutely no sense in terms of what's happening in the present. That can be memory. Sensations, which are body pain or body sensations, can be memory. And then the knowledge of what it's all about and why you're experiencing all of this usually comes last. So basically that's knowing what happened and what they specifically did, I'm always formulating the question, what could have happened to this person as a child or as an adult to make them tell me this, or what is it they're trying to tell me? And if I can get a picture, and they're giving me metaphors, if I can get a picture of what it is that they're trying to tell me, then we can design an intervention together that will deal with, because and help them get to what the original memory is, what actually did happen. And I can do that very non-directly. Mm. I mean, I don't have to say, okay, this happened to you, and that happened to you, and this other thing happened to you. I can say, what is this associated with, or what does this remind you of? What's going on? What do you see? Visualize for me. Give me a word picture of what you see inside. So I can ask a series of questions. And it's helpful for me to know the possibilities that go with what they're describing, because then I can, you know, as I said, makes it a little bit quicker in terms of... And then if they tell me stuff, I know what they're talking about. Mm. If it's electric shock memories, there's a certain way that those feel. There's certain parts of the body where they're more likely to be. I know that we can take the electrodes off. But I get them to tell me that. Mm-hmm. And I was really lucky in that a client remembered all these conversations and wrote them out for me, and I got a really clear idea of what the thought was behind the experiments and what a lot of the experiments are. Although there seem to be because I have clients that come from all over the country, not just from New Orleans, so there seem to be real variations. Mm-hmm. In regions, in terms of what the focus was, in terms of the experiments, there's some commonalities, and there are things that are different. Mm-hmm.